At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's book show. Happy New Year to you as well. I hope you enjoyed the party season and are back to normal now. Takes a while, doesn't it? Joining us on the book show tonight is Faye Weldon, CBE. She's the best-selling author of the classic The Life and Loves of a She-Devil, a sequel to her acclaimed Love and Inheritance trilogy Before the War came out last year. After the Peace is the fifth novel in the Dilburn family saga and is the story of Rosalind. She has also released a handbook for the rejected writer called Why Will No One Publish My Novel? It was also great to have Geoffrey Archer back on the show, who burst onto the literary scene 42 years ago and is the only UK author ever to have been a number one bestseller in fiction, short stories and non-fiction. His latest novel, Heads You Win, is hailed as the Cain and Abel for the 21st century and is his first standalone novel in nearly a decade. Also joining us is Maureen Moss, who lives near Torrevieja on the Costa Blanca. Her debut novel, More to Life, is a romp around the world by a middle-aged, recently divorced woman who is running away from her problems and begins a year-long exploration. And finally, Diana Kay is on the show. She's known to her many blog fans as Delia Despair. She was a journalist with the Daily Telegraph, who's also written a memoir called The Grown-Ups Wouldn't Like It. Her anthology of short stories, Love, Lies and Lunch, contains stories about women who find themselves in unexpected and socially awkward circumstances. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is best-selling author Faye Weldon, CBE. She's the author of the classic The Life and Loves of a She-Devil and The Cloning of Joanna May. A sequel to her acclaimed Love and Inheritance trilogy Before the War was published last year, and just recently After the Peace has come out, which is the fifth novel in the Dilburn family saga. We're also going to be talking about her latest non-fiction book, which is called Why Will No One Publish My Novel? It's a handbook for the rejected writer, and it's packed full of advice, not only on how to write a novel, but also how not to write if you want to get published. Welcome to the book show, Faye.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm extremely well.
Good, good. It's lovely to catch up with you. So what, you've been busy then, two books out in the space of a couple of months.
It is true, yes. I do feel a bit tired, it's true. And I do have a cold in the nose, so you will have to excuse the slight sort of hesitation in my voice.
Oh, don't worry. Do you enjoy writing the non-fiction books as much as you do the fiction?
I absolutely loved writing the handbook because it was non-fiction and you didn't have to make it up. You just wrote about what you knew. It was such relief.
Easier, I suppose, in a way.
Well, it sort of it is. I mean, it involves a different part of the brain. And the inventive part is one that really sort of exhausts you. But this one, it's sort of rational and great fun, actually. And you also feel useful.
And what made you decide to write it, the novel book?
Because I teach creative writing at Bath Spa University in Somerset. And, you know, I have a train of students coming before me, most of them postgraduates, who pay vast sums of money to learn how to write novels. And it is such a sort of noble craft. And not all of them, I mean, because one hopes they've been taught by me, they don't all get turned down. But enough get turned down to realize what a shock and blow it is. You spend years writing, you can spend years writing novels and sort of not going to parties and annoying your friends and family and talking about your novel. And then it's all, if it's turned down, it sort of seems all about nothing. In my theory, that a lot of what is turned down nowadays is accidentally turned down. And if you looked out your old novel and worked on it, which takes time and work and is kind of boring, you might well get it published.
Mm.
So is this a way of sort of helping people to get out their old novels?
Do you think people make the same mistakes with the novels and reasons why they're not getting published?
Oh, absolutely. No, they do. They do. They don't sort of realize what they're doing, and just a word or two will put it to can, put it all right. But a lot of people, write very well and think they're doing it right, but they're not. What they're doing is annoying editors and our publishers by sort of annoying tricks and not realizing you have to have something special about your novel as compared to other people's novels.
Mm-hmm.
Easy enough to fix it, to taste.
And what sort of annoying habits do people tend to have, do you think?
Well, there's a whole list of them in the book. Sort of the reasons why your novel was turned down, which agents will never tell you, but sometimes it's too devastating for readers to hear, for the writers to hear. I mean, for example, the most recent one, too boring.
Mm.
The reason it's too boring is because you haven't engage yourself in the novel. You haven't sort of known, you have done it by rote or tried to work it out rationally, and this is not as what is required. If you put in some of yourself, then it becomes human and people will react to it, because readers do. So that is one thing. That's the most difficult one to get over, I grant you. And there's no USP, which is unique selling proposition. Why this one rather than another one? And if an agency has 25 books to get through that day, they will see things, oh yes, all right, but not quite special. Where is the thing that makes this one stand out? And they won't find it. But if you think about this yourself, it probably is in there. You just haven't sort of put it up high enough on the agenda as you write. And all sorts of things. I mean, it can be that you're just illiterate. Well, if you are, you'd better start reading and sort of learning how to do the basics before you start doing the novel. Or, there are ways around all these things, which requires work and also introspection sometimes, which is the most painful thing of all.
Mm.
But it's there to be done and can be done, because the novel you have written reflects you. So, you'd better be there.
Yes, and it's important, I think, to grab readers quite quickly, isn't it? People want to be grabbed early on. You don't want to have to get through three chapters before you're really into the novel, because some people might give up before they get that far.
Well, they just give up on the first page, on the first paragraph. They just don't want to turn the page, because you have given them no incentive. So there needs to be a reason. It can be very slight, like somebody's put the milk on and you don't want it to boil over. That makes you want to turn the page. And you just build on that and you make sure every page you write it, the reader turns, they want to actually turn it.
Mm.
And have the incentive to do it. And that is what the writer is required to do.
And with regards to sending all the relevant information to an agent, which is often the first step for people, each agent will be very specific on the website in terms of what they want to be sent, and it's very important to follow those rules, isn't it?
I don't believe a word any agent puts on their website. they open the book, they read the first page, if they want to read on, they will take it.
Mm.
So that is, but in a way, I mean, agents are in the business of keeping people from sending them manuscripts.
Yeah.
They get so many. I mean, it's about 95% of all novels submitted don't get published, which is an enormous thing. So yours has to be the one that they take. But it can be, but they say that, but it's not. I mean, a good book gets through one way or another. All those good books.
But they don't ask for the whole novel, do they? They want like a synopsis and a chapter breakdown and things like that.
Yes, your synopsis is terribly important, actually. And not having the right synopsis or getting it wrong or getting bogged down in plot. Because agents don't want plots, they want reasons to sell the book. The agent is going to approach a publisher with a book. And so you have to tell the agent what the agent is going to tell the publisher and get the book through. And your synopsis needs to be only a page long, not just John did this and Jane did that, but why this book's interesting, where it is set, who you think, not how good it is on their account, because they're the ones who are going to judge that, but where it's set, and who you think might appreciate it, and then follow it with a very brief synopsis within a page of what the book's about. Mm-hmm. The mood it's in and the tone it's in, which is important, and the readership you're after, and it's genre, though again, genre, there's so many genres these days, that's a bit mistaken. But they need to know about the whole of your book, not just sort of what you who've been writing it thinks about the book.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at it from the outside and present that. So it's a sort of common sense, really.
It must be very difficult for people to know whether they should keep going or not. If they've had numerous rejection letters from publishers or agents and they keep tweaking it. And I mean, it happened to J.K. Rowling, didn't it? So it can be worth pursuing.
I say if after six rejections they said no, and you still think it's good and you still want to go on, then you should read this book before you... and realise why it's happening and think about it, and then only then sort of realise you may be sending it to the wrong people, and then you can always change its title and send it to the same agent again. They'll never know.
Yeah. So your latest novel is After the Peace, which is the fifth novel in the Dilben family saga. Tell us about the Dilbens.
Well, the Dilbens have been going on a long time. They started in 1900, and the stories have all been really about the Dilben descendants. The Dilbens, you know, were lucky in money, unlucky in love, and this seems to be a curse which goes right down through the family. This particular one takes us right back to the present and a little bit into the future, not much. Starts with the sperm bank and the young Lord Dilben, the latest one, sort of donating his sperm at a time when you got £25 and you could do it anonymously, which only went on for about 3 years. And so this is Lord Dilben's, and it's about 30 years later that it actually, this girl is born on the stroke of the new millennium. And so she is, if you like, a millennium merging into a snow of the snowflake generation. And she inherits these genes, which are pretty dodgy in the first place. And it's her adventures and what happens to her.
Fantastic. And that's Rosalind.
And this is, yes, she's Rosie.
She's
basically known as Rosie. But she objects to that. I mean, she's offended. She's very easily offended, this poor girl. And understandably, she has a right to be offended.
And have you enjoyed writing about this family throughout the books?
No, it has been great fun. John has had really total freedom, because John has taken another individual, but you know that there is a particular gene which is a very destructive and nasty one, which runs through the whole family. So all the villains can have this gene, and all the nice ones can have the nice gene. So, it's been lovely to work on.
And would you say your writing, because you've been doing it for a while now, does it get any easier, or is each book just as hard?
Well, it's hard in one way and easier in another. I mean, how I deal with material gets easier, because I'm so used to it. Sort of creating the material, creating the people remains as difficult and as hazardous and as risky as ever.
And do you feel the pressure after these years to still produce great books that people want to read?
Well, I wouldn't know what it was like not to, I'm afraid. what would I do?
No, so you're happy where you are.
So I am happy where I am, and I love teaching, which is, I think, you know, I think as you get older, you should pass on what you know.
Hmm. You must get great feedback from your students, do you?
Well, I get great feedback from them. No, but I mean, the spirit of invention, I think, is very rare, and I'm fortunate enough to, you know, to interview students and understand what it is, what they're capable of, because some people, I mean, lots more people are capable of writing novels than think they are, that's nice. But then, at the same time, not more people think they're capable, who are not.
Must be difficult for people to be properly self-critical and judgmental of their own work. I suppose some people will think they're brilliant when they're not, and some people will think they're really not very good when they are.
Well, that is a problem. But I find the problem, the greater problem, is people who think they're terribly good, and they are terribly good. I mean, they're wonderful writers, some of them, but they can't construct a novel. They can't do plots and structure. It's what bothers them. They can't. They can do, as a student, a sort of 1,000 words of absolutely exquisite work. At the end of the year, they've got sort of 20 pieces of exquisite work with no way of joining them together.
Because they've
left out all the boring bits, and the boring bits are what sort of hold the thing together and tell the story. So, you know, you never know. I mean, you can be considered the best writer but still not be able to write a novel. Or you can be not so good a novel, but not so good a writer, but be able to construct and sell a novel which gives people great pleasure.
So
very often the students, I sort of go on having to read pencil about tenses and grammar and stuff, and the ones which actually get through, and the ones who sort of drop your jaw in admiration are the ones that don't necessarily make it.
Interesting. So that's where an editor comes in, doesn't it? A good editor.
Yes, and good editors are very rare.
Really?
Well, it's very special. It is a very special vocation. And quite often these days, publishers don't even accept submissions from agents, or they don't trust the agents. The agents will go to great lengths. Not all. I'm not talking about all agents. Lots of good ones are brilliant. But some now these days especially think, oh, being an agent, that's a good way of making money. Now, what do readers want? So I will, if I get a novel and somebody sends it in, I will work on it myself. And they don't, and then they will sort of follow the trend and make my writers, as I call them, work, changing what they've got to something that actually nobody wants in the end. And it's a hard life out there in publishing, I can tell you, and in writing, and in agenting.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of After the Peace, The Spoils of War, Book 2, it's the fifth novel in the Dilben family saga. That is out now and available to buy on our website, as is Why Will No One Publish My Novel, A Handbook for the Rejected Writer, both by Faye Weldon. Faye, thank you so much for joining us. Always lovely to chat with you.
Indeed, it's been a great pleasure to hear you again.
Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us back on the book show is Geoffrey Archer. Now, with 36 books, 275 million copies sold, and 26 Sunday Times number one bestsellers, Geoffrey Archer is a global publishing phenomenon. 42 years since he first burst onto the literary scene, he is the only UK author ever to have been a number one bestseller in fiction, short stories, and non-fiction. His latest book, Heads You Win, is described as the Cain and Abel for the 21st century. It's his first standalone novel in nearly a decade. Welcome to the book show, Geoffrey.
Thank you, Hannah. Good to be back on the book show.
Oh, it's lovely to have you back. So your first standalone novel in nearly a decade, how did it feel doing this one?
Very strange, because of course the Clifton Chronicles, 7 books in a row covering the life of Harry Clifton and Emma and Giles, was such a challenge. But I got this wonderful idea from reading Colin Powell's memoirs, My American Journey, when his mother Maud, a seamstress, said, I've got to get away from Jamaica and start a new life. And she couldn't make up her mind whether to go to Great Britain or whether to go to the United States. Of course, we all know she chose the United States. But I became fascinated by the idea of what would have happened if the great Colin Powell, who later became Secretary of State in America, had come to Britain and not America. And so I used that idea, but decided to start the story in Russia, in St. Petersburg, with a young man called Alexander, who had won a scholarship to the great language school in Moscow. And his father was a trade union leader who was killed by the KGB. And so his mother, Elena, a very strong woman, decided they had to escape. And when they arrived at the docks, there were two crates, one going to the United States, one going to Britain. And Alexander had to make up his mind which he wanted to get into.
What an interesting idea. It's a fascinating one to think about, isn't it? And the idea, as you say, of Colin Powell, what could have happened if he came to Britain?
Well, I think if he'd come to Britain 50 years ago, he would have been unlikely to have become a cadet at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. I think it unlikely that he would have become a field marshal. I think it unlikely he would have followed Alec Douglas Hume and Peter Carrington as Foreign Secretary. If he'd come to Britain today, 50 years later, that would have been very different, because we have a shadow Home Secretary, the first black woman MP, and our Home Secretary is a Muslim man. So it would be very different if he came today. So I set it later on, and you'll see what I tried to show.
Yes, great. And how do you feel about the idea of it being called the Cain and Abel for the 21st century? Do you get that comparison?
Well, certainly the readers and the critics have been very flattering and very kind, but I always leave it to the public to decide that. And they've made Cain and Abel so special, with 32 million sales right around the world, that it's very hard for me to believe I'll manage to do that twice.
It's amazing, isn't it? I suppose it must be every author's dream to write a book that years and years later is still relevant and people are still reading and enjoying it.
Well, you've got it, Hannah, in one. Years and years later is the secret. Next year, we celebrate the 40th year of Cain and Abel, and it's still selling every single day. So you're quite right, and we'll celebrate the 40th anniversary, and its 123rd reprint.
Wow, fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, 42 years since you've been writing now and publishing books. When you first started, did you think it would become your life?
Oh, no. Not a penny more, not a penny less. My first book only sold 3,000 copies, and my wife suggested I got a proper job. So no, certainly not.
And do you think you're going to just keep continuing writing books?
Oh, yes, I'm very happy, thank you. I know where I'm going next. In the Clifton Chronicles, you will remember that Harry Clifton was an author, and his hero was William Warwick, a detective in the Metropolitan Police. And I've had so many letters wanting to know more about William Warwick and wanting me to write about William Warwick, that I shall be doing a series starting with Constable Warwick and working his way all the way up through Inspector, Superintendent, until he becomes the Commissioner. But I've got, Hannah, to live long enough to do it.
Fingers crossed for that, then. That must be nice, getting so much feedback from readers encouraging you to write particular books that maybe you haven't thought of yourself.
It's wonderful. One of my people I work with came in this morning, and I say work with, she does a job here once a month, and she came in, and she's Portuguese, and she said, everybody's talking about your book. And I thought, you know, if you've hit it at that level, then you've really, you're with the people.
Yeah, definitely. I read that it's been banned in Russia, though.
Yes. I beg people not to reveal the ending. I beg people not to reveal the final twist. And the critics have been very kind. But once they do find out, they will find out why I've been banned in Russia, which is sad, because my books have always been published in Russia and have been successful. And it's a great sadness for me that I will not be published in Russia. I will be published in the Ukraine and in Georgia and in Germany and in the Czech Republic and in Poland. But of course, none of those are in the Russian language.
I'm sure it won't hurt, though, hopefully. They say all publicity.
Doing any harm at all.
No, all publicity is good publicity, isn't it? I also read a lovely article with the headline, "I feel guilty about my £200 million fortune, so I'm giving it away." Is that true?
Well, I've reached an age when I've started, the family have decided thinking about which of my pictures should go to major galleries. And Mary in particular, my wife, who's a great scientist, of course, chairman of the Science Museum and a great educationalist, has decided that we really should be giving money to children's charities and to educational charities.
So is that all in progress now?
It's been going on for the past 5 years.
Yes. Ah, fantastic. Well, it's always a pleasure to chat with you, Geoffrey Archer. Thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you, Anna.
And best of luck with Heads You Win. And we look forward to catching up again soon.
Yes, please. Thank you very much indeed.
Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Maureen Moss. She's a resident of La Mata near Torrevieja. She's released her debut novel, More to Life. It's a romp around the world by a middle-aged, recently divorced woman who's running away from her marital and domestic problems. Maureen is an active member of the Torrevieja Writers Circle and also runs the website Tour Guide Course, offering a course leading to a qualification for other would-be tour leaders. Welcome to the book show, Maureen.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
It's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. So before we talk about your book, tell me about this tour guide course that you do.
Right. Yes, I worked for many years as a tour guide all over the world. And in my book, because I love travel so much, it's the best sort of job you could possibly wish for, because you actually get paid to go traveling with people who are also very fond of traveling. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. So you're with people of the same sort of frame of mind, you know, the same outlook on life, getting paid to go and visit the most amazing countries. So I was so thrilled with it as a job. I really enjoyed it. You have to like people to do the job, obviously. That when I stopped doing it, I decided that I wanted to share what I knew with people who might want to become tour guides. So I was looking for a business to do, because basically I was a full-time teacher. I wanted then to do something from home. And so I just decided to get some coaching around building a website and then constructing the course. And I put it on a platform for travel, you know, for people in the travel industry. And last year it came off there because their website wasn't very stable. And people could get the course without paying for it. There wasn't much point in that for me or them, really. Mm. So for the last year, I've been trying to market it on my own, but I haven't got much experience of online marketing. But nevertheless, it's there, and it's for, you know, people who would like to be tour guides, or abroad for local guides who, because they haven't got experience of traveling to different countries, are normally employed to show people around their local area, which is a great job in itself. But this course would enable them to have the skills involved with booking tickets, arranging itineraries for people, and traveling outside of their own country so that they could have more interesting work in other countries.
That sounds like a great idea, because the thing about being a tour guide is you don't just need to have a love of travel and people. As you say, you need to know about the areas that you're taking people to. So research must come into it a lot.
Yeah, yes, I've got a whole section on how to do destination research. Usually, if you're working for a big tour operating company, they will provide you with, in the company I worked for, it was the tour manual. In other companies, they call it something different probably. But in there, it does give you a lot of information about the destination. So you can, if you're going to be giving a talk, you can prepare it the night before or something like that, so that you you know a little bit about the places that you're going to visit. But a tour guide, the sort of tour guide that I'm thinking is like more of a tour leader, really, because you're going to be going to lots of different countries and you cannot possibly know as much as a local guide would know. So it's more of an overview of the skills that you need and the documentation that you have to be able to handle, how to interact with local guides and with, you know, authorities in the area that you're visiting, how to cope in the case of an accident. Obviously, first aid is quite high, but also, you know, what sort of administration you need to do in the case of something going wrong, which we hope it never does. But, you know, life doesn't always have everything 100% perfect.
Yes.
So sometimes you do have to deal with emergencies. And all that is there. So it's really a course for people who want to be not just in one destination, because you cannot possibly know as a tour guide everything about every single place you travel to. I suppose you'd be a robot if you knew that.
Yes. And what about the Torrevieja Writers' Circle? What happens there?
Oh, right. Now, that's wonderful. Yes. We meet on a Wednesday. And we have just a couple of hours. The first hour is spent with people reading out something that they've written. And that often goes on into after the coffee break. We reassemble and we then carry on doing that. Sometimes we have what we call a hot pen, where we all turn up and the person who's chairing the meeting will pick a random topic and we all write something for 10 minutes and then we read it out. And it's amazing how sort of up to, you know, 15 to 20 people will all write something completely different about the same topic. It's quite fascinating. And it can be anything. It can be a newspaper report. It can be a piece of fiction. It can be a poem. It can be a dialogue. It can be a rant, you know, it can be whatever you like. So the idea is that we prepare something. We are given topics to write about only if we can't think of anything that we want to bring. So, for example, I'm writing the second part of my story that I had published, and I usually take something from there to have it critiqued. But if for some reason you haven't got something that you want to bring, then you've got a topic that you're invited to write about as well. And so we read out our work and the rest of the group critique it in very much a positive and warm way. There's no, you know, that's a lot of rubbish or anything like that. It's sort of, you know, we thought that was really good. We might suggest that you started paragraph two instead of paragraph one because we think that's got more impact, or you used too many adjectives there, or, you know, that kind of thing. So it's all
constructive criticism.
Exactly. yes.
So looking at your book then, More to Life, this is your debut novel. How did you find the writing process of it all?
Well, to be completely honest with you, it took me 15 years or so, 20 years, I think, to write it. I started it in 1998. I only published it last year. Well, I got it published last year, I should say. So it took a long time. I did three drafts before I ended up with the final one, and that was of the whole book. First of all, I tried doing it as a sort of a diary. Then I tried to inject some humour into the diary. It just didn't work to try and superimpose one thing onto another thing. So I started again from scratch and wrote it as a story. So it's based on fact, but a lot of it is pure fiction. So apart from the actual countries that are involved in the story, the rest of it is fiction.
Okay. But it's kind of based on you and your experiences, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. In 1997, well, my husband left in 1992, got divorced in about 93, 94. And then in 1997, I had bought his half of our family home from him. I can't remember the actual details now of how it was sorted out. But anyway, I was living in the house with the three children, who were then all teenagers. And what I did was I sold that house, and with the money, I took the children on a trip around the world for a whole year.
Wow.
And yeah. So I spent all of the money that got from the house on traveling, you know.
How fantastic.
And for my kids, it was fantastic too, because they were old enough to appreciate the places that we were going, but they were still teenagers. So, yeah.
Brilliant. How did it work taking them out of school?
Well, the younger one actually only came out to join the older ones in the school holidays.
Okay.
So my youngest daughter stayed at school. She stayed with her dad and went to school for most of the school term. She sometimes finished, you know, a few weeks early so that she could make it worthwhile to come out to wherever we were. So she came, first of all, to Australia, and then she came to LA and Mexico.
How amazing. I bet they loved it, did they?
Yes.
Yeah. Just like some of the time.
Yes. I mean, I was very much aware of operating on a budget, a tight budget. So we tended to stay in the cheapest possible places. You know, hotels, for example, in which country was it? It must have been in might have been Vietnam. It was in India. I beg your pardon. Yeah, a hotel in India. We actually nicknamed it Cockroach Hotel.
Oh, no.
Because there were cockroaches running up the walls and over your...
Oh, goodness.
Over the, so that was probably the worst place we stayed in.
But a real adventure for them.
Yes. Oh, yes, it was. And, yeah, just, you know, it was just really... It was amazing. It was fantastic.
And do they have a love of travel now, do you think?
One of them doesn't. I mean, he's settled down. He has traveled since. He went to Brazil. That was my son. And he works in the finance industry in Guernsey. And he's now got two little children of his own. So, you know, I don't think he's got the same wanderlust that my older daughter and my youngest daughter had after we did our traveling. He was quite happy to go back to the comfort of Guernsey in the Channel Islands, which is where we were living at the time.
Yeah, fair enough. So what can you tell us more about the character in the book? What's she called?
Well, the main character is called Rachel.
Okay.
She's filled with anxiety about her relationship with the youngest daughter, who's called Sophie. And the youngest daughter is the one based on my youngest daughter, who stayed at school and came out to join us just in the school holidays. And Rachel she keeps agonizing over how Sophie must feel, you know, is she feeling abandoned and blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of that. She's also really kind of obsessed with finding out about the new science, you know, the science of quantum world rather than test tubes and all that kind of stuff that we did at school.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't have any science knowledge, any sort of knowledge of the technology, the terminology. So she's struggling to read books about quantum physics and absolutely nothing, no basis of understanding. You know, it's just all completely new to her. So that's the sort of the negative side. But she's very adventurous. She's up for trying new places, doing new things like skydiving and snorkeling and stuff like that. People will either think she's great or not. But she's unusual, certainly, in the sense that she's, you know, taking her children off around the world.
Yeah. And does she get something from it?
Oh, yes. She comes to terms with her own sort of demons, as it were, you know, her own doubts. She's still, it takes her almost the whole year to get over the divorce. For the few years preceding going traveling, she was basically a bit of a mess. You know, she was just eating too much, smoking, drinking too much, sitting watching the TV, putting on weight, and basically, you know, she just turned into a bit of a blob, really. But then once she starts the traveling, it just injects a new enthusiasm for life into her. And she's fascinated to find out about other cultures, see other countries. So she grows a lot during that year. She goes from being a bit sort of self-indulgent, self-obsessed with, you know, what, oh, is she a bad mother? Was she a bad wife? Was she any good as a teacher? Into being someone at the very end of it all who's got a completely new outlook on life and a lot more self-confidence. So she does grow throughout the year.
Fantastic. And presumably you did too.
Yes, I did, certainly.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah. So are you already thinking about another book?
I'm about two-thirds of the way through it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing this morning. It's going to be called There's a Funnel Web on the Floor.
Right.
That is based on reality as well. In Sydney, I stayed with some friends who were teachers, and I borrowed their car and went off doing some sightseeing and then came back, and out of the corner of my eye, I noticed this black thing scurrying across the kitchen floor. Mm-hmm. And it was heading towards my bedroom, which had the door open. So I thought, I'll just pick it up, because I always did just pick spiders up. And something, fortunately, stopped me. And instead of picking it up, I put a glass over it. And it, inside of the glass was instantly coated with all this milky, creamy, white stuff.
Oh, gosh.
And when my friends came home, I showed it to them and said, don't know what that did. They said, oh my God, it's a funnel web. You know, it could have been fatal if you'd actually picked it up. And
oh,
bit you.
So, goodness. Oh my
so
goodness.
That's true. And that it does come in the story. And I thought that would be quite a good title for it.
Yes. Really gets you thinking.
Yeah. Well, what's that about? Yeah.
Exactly. Well, if people want to find out more about the tour guide course that we were talking about, first of all, tourguidecourse.com is the website. And people can get a copy of your book, More to Life, from our website in the TRE bookshop section. That's tre.radio. It's by Maureen Moss, who we've been chatting to. Maureen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been really delightful. Thank you very much, Hannah.
Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Diana Kay, who's known to her many blog fans as Delia Despair. She was a journalist with the Daily Telegraph and has written two other books, How to Get On with the Boss and her memoir, The Grown-Ups Wouldn't Like It. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest book. It's an anthology of short stories called Love, Lies and Lunch. It's about women who find themselves in unexpected and socially awkward circumstances or have to face up to unwelcome truths. Welcome to the book show, Diana.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us. So tell me, where does this Delia Despair come from?
Well, I wanted a pen name. I wanted something sort of fairly funny because my blog is on the funny side of life. So I was thinking of what I could call myself, and I decided on Delia Despair, a bit like Lydia Languish.
Yes, fantastic. So how long have you been doing your blog for?
A few years now. I started just before I published my last book, which was The Grown-Ups Wouldn't Like It. I did it and started then, and it's still on. I don't do it that often, and I get roughly 200 hits a week.
Great stuff. So tell me the different things that you write about.
Well, they're mostly things that have gone wrong, like being scammed. I'm pretty stupid about being scammed in the
past. Oh, no. Really?
I've learnt my lesson now, I think.
Oh.
But lots of things, and trying to do things online and not getting through and sort of saying, oh, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah. Yes. There's a lot of that, isn't there?
Yes.
So I guess you're getting a great response from people who are going through exactly the same thing.
Yes, that's right. I wrote, I think one of the most successful one was one I wrote saying, I don't like Mozart, which I expected everybody to be horrified by. Because everybody likes Mozart, but not me. And I like the romantic composers. And I got lots of responses from people who said, no, we don't like Mozart either.
Oh, fabulous. And your book that I mentioned, The Grown-Ups Wouldn't Like It, that came out a few years ago, talks about some of the interesting people who you've met over the years, from Somerset Maugham to Noel Coward, John Gielgud, Fanny Craddock. How did all that happen?
Well, I met Noel Coward, John Gielgud in Jamaica. I was a governess for a horrible woman. She's very, very rich, and she's one of those people who you're always to blame for anything that goes wrong in her life. And that's where I met Noel Coward and John Gielgud. Fanny Craddock I met when I was working on the Daily Telegraph. Who else did you say?
Somerset Maugham.
Oh, Somerset Maugham. When I was 15, I went to Switzerland, and I met him there. He was in hospital. And Brendan, I thought Somerset Maugham was wonderful because I loved his short stories, which were a terrific inspiration for me.
Yes.
So I said to my friend who was in Switzerland with me, I said, let's go and visit him in the hospital. So we went, and it was amazing that we actually got there because it was a very grand building and he was on the seventh floor or something. And we just walked in. Well, we didn't actually walk in. We took him a box of fruit, peaches and grapes, and gave it to somebody and said, we'd like Somerset Maugham to have this. And the nurse said, oh, he'd like to have a word with you. So we went in, and he was very old, and he was in the corner of the room, and he didn't speak. He just gave a little wave. And then I exaggerated terrifically to the people I was with. I was living with a family who were lovely in Lausanne, and I told them that we'd spoken at great length, which is totally untrue. I've always exaggerated things in my life, and my father used to say how awful I was, really, because I was always exaggerating things. And anyway,
so makes for a good storyteller, I'd say.
Yes. Yeah, I've written short stories all my life, ever since I was 5 years old. That was my first one. I've always written short stories.
How lovely. So is this a collection of stories that you've written throughout your life, or have you done them all more recently?
No, most of them are, I suppose in... My daughter was at school, and we needed money for her for education, and so I was trying to make a bit of money, so I aimed them, the short stories, at the teenage magazines and sold quite a lot. But other than that, they could be anything, really. I've just always written short stories.
And how do you decide what the subject of each story is going to be about? How does the whole process work?
Well, sometimes it's something in my life that I've heard about, and I think, oh, that's interesting. I mean, for instance, a friend of mine had a stepson who didn't like her and said he wanted to lock her up in a house made of sticks and burn it down. And I wrote a story called The Wicked Stepmother, and that was based on that one. Usually there's something in my life that just occurs to me, and I find it suitable for a story.
Yes.
And then there was one about a man who decides to get married after his wife died to a real slut, and his daughter's terribly, terribly upset about it. She seeks revenge over when they're together at some point. And then there's another one about a boy and girl cousins, and one of them, who's only 16, has fallen in love, and the boy and girl decide to play a joke on her and pretend it's the boyfriend who's gone off the boil. And it has disastrous results because she's so upset, she runs out into the road and gets run over. So that was another one.
Wow.
There's just lots of different ones. And then there's a ghost story. There's one about Nigeria, where my parents were in Nigeria. And there was a strange woman who they liked and I didn't. And I based it on her.
So there's really something for everyone.
I'd like to think so, but I don't know really.
When did you put all the book together?
Well, my daughter said, why don't you publish an anthology? Because she always loved the story. She was a teenager. And a lot of them had been published in magazines. So I decided to do that. And that's how it came about, really.
And why did you want to make them short stories as opposed to making them into novels? Because there's some great stories there.
Yes, well, I don't know. I just always preferred writing short stories. I was very influenced by Somerset Maugham. I loved his short stories. I just went along that road, I suppose.
Yeah, fantastic. I always find it fascinating why short stories aren't more popular, because everybody's always complaining how they don't have time for so many things. So you'd think people would be dipping in and out of short story books all the time.
Well, that's the nice thing about this, because a lot of people, friends who've got the book, say how much they're enjoying them, and the fact that they are short stories, they can read one at night.
Yeah.
And so it works quite well, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if people want to get a copy of Love, Lies and Lunch, an anthology of short stories, it's out now. It's by Diana Kay, who we've been chatting to. It's available to buy on our website on tre.radio in the bookshop section. Diana Kay, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.